Medicom Medical Publishers produces peer-reviewed reports and highlights on major medical meetings. We bring the Congress to the physician.
Welcome to this podcast brought to you by Medicom Medical Publishers. My name is Dr. Rachel Giles. I'm the Medical Science Officer at Medicom. And today I have selected six presentations from the European Alliance of Associations for Rheumatology. That's the EULAR and their 2022 annual meeting. It was held in Copenhagen this year on site and was also virtually held between the 1st and the 4th of June 2022, marking EULAR's 75th anniversary. Enjoy listening.
Thank you to all the healthcare professionals who have worked so hard to bring us through the current pandemic.
Let's talk about the SELECT ACCESS 2 trial. It's a phase 3 trial, and this presentation was held by Professor Flip van de Bolsch from Ghent University in Belgium. So this was looking at upadacitinib and how it led to an assessment of Spondyloarthritis International Society 40 or ASAS 40 response in about 45% of patients with active non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis. So that non-radiographic axial spondyloarthritis, that's shortened to NR-AXS-SPA. Both TNF blockers and IL-17 blockers have shown to be effective in NR-AXS-SPA, but of course there are patients that primarily fail these treatments, and sometimes patients respond well and lose response later, or they can develop toxicity. So after having another mode of action and not directly against a single cytokine, but against an inflammatory pathway, for example, that might be useful. The phase 3 randomized SELECT ACCESS 2 trial looked at adults with a clinical diagnosis of NR-AXS-SPA who also fulfilled the 2009 ASAS classification criteria and who were treated with upadacitinib 15 milligrams once daily, and there were 157 in that group, or placebo, also 157 group in that group. Professor van der Bolsch said, quote, according to a central reading, participants did not meet radiologic criterion of modified New York criteria, but had signs of active disease, namely elevated C-reactive protein concentrations or sacroiliitis in MRI. About a third of the participants were previously treated with a biologic disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drug, or DMARDs, mostly TNF blockers or IL-17 inhibitors. And all participants had shown an inadequate response to at least two non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. After 14 weeks, 45% of the participants randomized to receive upadacitinib achieved the primary endpoint, which was ASAS 40 response, compared with only 23% of those assigned to the placebo arm of the trial with a highly significant p-value. Professor van der Bolsch said, quote, I have three take-home messages here. There was a clear difference between upadacitinib and placebo. The absolute difference is in the ballpark of other biologics, around 40 or 50%. And lastly, we saw a fast response with a separation of curves already at week 2. Upadacitinib was also superior in other multiplicity-controlled secondary endpoints, including change from baseline in patients' assessment of total back pain, ankylosing spondylitis disease activity score, so the ASDAS, BATH, ankylosing spondylosis functional index, or BASFI, ankylosing spondylitis quality of life measures, ASQOL, and MRI Spondyloarthritis Research Consortium of Canada, the SPARC, for sacroiliac joint inflammation. Overall, the safety profile of upadacitinib was consistent with what's been observed previously and in other inflammatory musculoskeletal diseases, with no new risks identified. Moving on to juvenile idiopathic arthritis. This was a presentation by Professor Athi Malaipet Ramanan from Bristol Medical School in the United Kingdom, who talked about the phase 3 Juve BASIS trial. So, started off by saying, quote, our patients and parents have been waiting for oral alternatives to injectable drugs, and the JAK inhibitors have come at the right time. Looking at baricitinib in juvenile idiopathic arthritis, or JIA. This trial had an unusual design. Quote, all patients, in order to be ethical and also not to subject our pediatric patients to placebo, were given access to the drug, and at 12 weeks, the responders were randomized on a one-to-one basis to either continue the drug or switch to placebo, Professor Ramanan explained. The double-blind withdrawal period extended from week 12 through week 44, and the primary endpoint was the time to disease flare. Enrolled JIA patients, and there were 220 of them, had to be between ages 2 and 18 years while having a history of inadequate response to conventional synthetic or biologic disease-modifying anti-rheumatic drugs, so corticosteroids or BD-MARDs. At baseline, the mean age of the participants was 13.3 years, and the mean disease duration was 4 years. Of the 220 participants, 52.7% had already been treated with biologics, 57.7% were on methotrexate, and 32.7% were on corticosteroids. After the lead-in period, JIA-ACR30 responses were reached by 76.3%, with corresponding rates for JIA-ACR50 scores at 63.5%, or JIA-ACR70 scores at 46.1%, and JIA-ACR90 scores at 20.1%. Professor Ramanan went on to say that, quote, "But the key was really in the withdrawal phase. Of the patients who stayed on baricitinib, 17.1% had a flare compared with 50.6% in the group that was switched to placebo, and that was a highly statistically significant result. Not only do those who get switched to placebo have a higher incidence of flaring, but they were also more likely to flare quickly as 4 weeks. Professor Ramanan commented on the significant result in the primary endpoint with a hazard ratio of 0.241, and that was a highly significant p-value in favor of baricitinib. In weeks 0 to 12, the discontinuation rate due to adverse events was 0.9%. During the withdrawal part, 2 participants in the placebo and 1 participant in the baricitinib arm ended the trial because of adverse events. From weeks 12 to 44, treatment-emergent adverse events were observed in 46.9% of placebo and 65.9% of baricitinib participants. Serious adverse events occurred in 3.7% from the placebo arm and 4.9% in the baricitinib arm of participants. And all in all, the researchers valued the safety results as consistent with the known safety profile of baricitinib. These findings support baricitinib, an oral JAK1/2 agent, as an alternative treatment for JIA patients with an inadequate response to corticosteroid or BD-MARD treatments. Professor Ramanan concluded, quote, "These are very interesting findings for our patients and parents of children with JIA," end quote. This presentation questioned the role of type 2 inhibition as a rising star in lupus therapy. It was presented by Professor Eric Morand from Monash University in Australia. And this was about the phase 2 Paisley trial. And it looked at the efficacy and safety of deucravacitinib in the treatment of patients with active systemic lupus in this phase 2 trial. The randomized controlled phase 2 Paisley study evaluated the type 2 inhibitor deucravacitinib as a treatment for active SLE. The primary endpoint was the number of participants who met the response criteria for the systemic lupus erythematosus responder index, or SRI, at week 32. All 363 participants were on stable background medication and lacked severe organ-threatening disease. After randomization, they were all treated in 4 separate groups, receiving either deucravacitinib 3 mg twice daily, 6 mg twice daily, 12 mg once daily, or placebo. Between week 8 and week 20 of the trial, a tapering of corticosteroids to 7.5 milligrams per day was obligatory. Thereafter, corticosteroids were kept stable until week 32. Professor Morand said, quote, "Following that, there was an optional steroid taper to week 40 and an 8-week period of stable steroids to week 48, at which time multiplicity adjusted key secondary outcomes were also measured," end quote. Participants were about 40 years old, predominantly women, and had a mean BMI of 26.8. Most of them had extensive background therapy. Just over 80% were treated with corticosteroids. 49.9% of them had a greater than or equal to 10 milligram dosage. 51.8% of them took immunosuppressants, and 32.2% had a triple treatment that further included antimalarials. The trial met its primary endpoint. The SRI-4 response was significantly lower in the placebo arm, 34.4%, than in the study drug groups at 58.2%. And this was dose-dependent. So for the 3 milligram twice daily group, this was 58.2%. For the 6 milligram twice daily group, this was 49.5%. And for the 12 milligrams once daily, it was 44.9%, and this last value is not quite significant, while the other two were. Quote, all secondary outcome measures were achieved or meaningfully improved at week 48, including SRI-4, British Isles Lupus Assessment Group-based composite lupus assessment, or the BICLA, low disease activity state, reduction in skin disease, and reduction in arthritis. Concerning safety, up to week 48, no deaths occurred, nor any other major adverse cardiac or thrombotic events. Serious adverse events were observed in 12.2% of placebo recipients and between 7.7% and 8.6% in the different deucravacitinib dose groups. Professor Morand underlined that there were no signals for either COVID-19 or herpes zoster. However, skin-related adverse events were higher in the deucravacitinib groups at 16.5%, 34.4%, 33.7%, and that was slightly higher than the 13.3% from the placebo arm. Professor Morand also pointed out that deucravacitinib did not demonstrate an effect on hematological markers or standard biochemistry. Professor Morand concluded, quote, deucravacitinib shows promise as a novel therapy for SLE and warrants further investigation in phase 3 trials, end quote. Next, we're going to talk about antifibrotic therapy, which is effective in patients with negative prognostic factors for lung function decline. And this was a presentation by Professor Christopher Denton from University College London in the United Kingdom about the CENSUS trial. So previously, nintedanib has been shown to slow lung function decline in patients with systemic sclerosis associated with interstitial lung disease, or SSC-ILD, and in the CENSUS trial. And this was a post-hoc analysis of this trial, and it looked at the treatment benefit in patients with four characteristics that are associated with a fast decline in lung function. So Professor Denton started off by saying, quote, the CENSUS trial reflected a real-world population and allowed broad inclusion criteria. Our analysis aimed to assess the effect of nintedanib on the rate of forced vital capacity, FVC, decline, but also focusing on subjects with risk factors for rapid FVC decline. In a post-hoc manner, the rate of decline FVC over 52 weeks was analyzed in subjects with the following four risk factors at baseline, so either early SSC, greater or less than or equal to 18 months since onset of the first non-Raynaud symptom, elevated inflammatory markers such as CRP greater than or equal to 6 milligrams per liter or very high platelet count, and significant skin fibrosis using two approaches, either the modified Rodnan skin score with scores between 15 and 40 or the MRRS score of being greater than or equal to 6. Compared with the total population of the CENSUS trial, participants with one of the four characteristics had a numerically greater decline in lung function. Professor Denton said, quote, conversely, once these patients are on nintedanib, there is a stabilization, end quote. These results support the prompt initiation of nintedanib in patients with SSC-ILD to preserve lung function and to improve patient outcomes. Professor Denton concluded, quote, I think that this is an important analysis in terms of our clinical practice and perhaps future trial designs. It does support using nintedanib in this group of patients that might be at particular risk for lung function decline, end quote. The Phase 3 B-Optimal trial was presented by Professor Ian McGuinness from Glasgow University in the United Kingdom, looking at the treatment with bimekizumab and whether it's beneficial in psoriatic arthritis. The IL-17A/IL-17F blocker bimekizumab is being tested in the Phase 3 B-Optimal trial as a therapy for psoriatic arthritis. This was a late-breaking session of the B-Optimal study and in untreated psoriatic arthritis patients, and there were 852 adult patients enrolled, and they all had at least one active psoriatic arthritis lesion and or diagnosis of psoriasis. As may be expected in a trial for psoriatic arthritis, the baseline features of the cohort included a mean age of around 49 years old. It was less than 50% men and just under 60% on concomitant methotrexate. Also, about 50% of the participants had body surface area affected by psoriasis of greater than or equal to 3%. The 16-week double-blind phase consists of three study arms in which participants were treated with placebo, and there are 281 of those. bimekizumab at 160 milligrams every 4 weeks, 431 patients in that group, or adalimumab 40 milligrams every 2 weeks, and there were 140 participants in that group as a reference arm. After week 16 followed an active treatment blind period in which the placebo participants were switched to bimekizumab until week 52. Professor McGinnis underlined that the study was neither designed nor powered for a head-to-head comparison between bimekizumab and adalimumab. The primary endpoint was the ACR50 response at week 16, and the results of an interim analysis at week 24 were also presented. The study was positive with statistically significant more participants in the bimekizumab arm achieving ACR50 over placebo participants at week 16. That was 43.9% for the interventional group versus 10% in the placebo group, with an odds ratio of the bimekizumab being 7.1 over placebo. The respective findings for ACR20 and ACR70 were 62.2% versus 23.8% and 24.4% versus 4.3%. So Professor McGinnis further stated, quote, through week 24, those responses were maintained and consistent, and the placebo patients who crossed over to bimekizumab rapidly recovered rates of response to be broadly similar to those patients who had already received the response by week 16. As for the ranked secondary outcomes, Professor McGinnis highlighted that bimekizumab was significantly superior to placebo when it came to skin amelioration at week 16, with rates of 61.3% versus 2.9%, reaching a psoriasis area and severity index, or PASI 90, and 47.5% versus 2%, reaching PASI 100. Bimekizumab was also significantly outperformed placebo in the achievement of minimal disease activity and inhibition of structural progression. The safety evaluation revealed no unexpected findings. Professor McGinnis added, quote, I want to point out that fungal infections, which occurred more frequently in the recipients of bimekizumab than adalimumab. Overall, bimekizumab was deemed to be very well tolerated, however. There was some news for polymyalgia rheumatica and IL-6 inhibition. This was a presentation from the Phase 3 SAPPHIRE trial presented by Dr. Bhaskar Dasgupta from Anglia Ruskin University in the United Kingdom. They're looking at sarilumab and whether it had clinical benefit for patients with polymyalgia rheumatica, or PMR. As IL-6 plays an important role in PMR, IL-6 inhibition with sarilumab was worth exploring, it was felt, and by now the research has advanced to the Phase 3 randomized double-blind SAPPHIRE trial. This trial included PMR patients of at least 50 years age who had had at least one flare within 12 weeks before the trial while being on more than or equal to 7.5 milligrams of prednisolone. The study aimed to enroll 280 patients, but recruitment halted at 118 participants due to the COVID-19 pandemic. Participants were allocated to either placebo plus 52-week glucocorticoid taper or sarilumab 200 milligrams every 2 weeks plus 14-week taper of glucocorticoids. The primary endpoint was defined as the rate of patients achieving sustained remission at week 52, and this included disease remission at week 12 plus the absence of flares, CRP normalization, and adherence to GC taper from weeks 12 to 52. The mean age of the participants was about 70 years, and they were mostly women. The median duration of PMR was 292 days in the sarilumab arm and 310 days in the placebo group. Professor Dasgupta pointed out that, quote, the median number of flares per patient was 2, and that was similar between the two groups, and many of these patients had received prior immunosuppression. At week 52, statistically significant difference was seen between the sarilumab and the placebo arms, with 28.3% in the sarilumab arm versus 10.3% in the placebo arm attaining sustained remission. Professor Dasgupta further highlighted that all the components of sustained remission showed a better result for sarilumab arm compared with the control arm. The study drug also clearly delayed the time to the first flare, and the risk for having a flare on sarilumab versus placebo was determined to have a hazard ratio of 0.56. In light of the study protocol, the researchers expect a higher use of glucocorticoids in the placebo arm, but Professor Dasgupta said, quote, but when we looked at the discrepancy between the actual and expected use, there was a 200 milligram difference between the actual and expected in the placebo arm, and this is related to a higher incidence of flares in the placebo arm. The safety profile of sarilumab observed in SAPPHIRE was consistent with earlier findings. Thank you for listening to this podcast. I hope you learned something about EULAR 2022. Stay safe and stay healthy.
This podcast was produced by Medicom Medical Publishers.